We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that we really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovics. Joining me today is the asset capitalist, Hugh Hendry. He's also a podcaster and a former global hedge fund manager. How are you today, Hugh? Thanks for joining me.
I'm great. Really good, Tom, to get on the show. Looking forward to it.
I'm looking forward to it as well. And, you know, as I was telling you before the show, I like to, you know, really get outside the normal, let's say, gold bug echo chamber sometimes. So I was happy to make contact with you to have a bit of a discussion to see your point of view and where you see things. But I thought we could start by having you tell us the story of when you originally launched your fund and what were some of the most important lessons, let's say, that you took from that time.
Well, okay. So I launched my hedge fund a bloody long time ago. At the very tail end of 2002. And I guess it's appropriate. Heavens, I just realized I'm listening to very high hertz frequency music to soothe my mind. Let me close it down. But I've been pontificating on Twitter in terms of how you set up not how you set up a hedge fund, but like the first year is critical. Mm-hmm. The majority of hedge funds fail. The incredible returns that you see from the survivors, of course, is the return to survivorship because there are so many who fail. Mm-hmm. Sitting here today, many, many years later, 20 odd years later, I think it's nigh on impossible to start up a hedge fund. There's not the investment interest. Allocators spend all of their time on their knees begging to get into the very large platforms. To be a hedge fund manager today means to get some capital from one of those allocation tools, those platforms. Back then it was different. Being a macro manager was a license to thrill. It was a license to do anything except lose money. It was the loosest mandate. I had a passport to travel across asset classes. It was rare. It's rare that you get the privilege to be able to, you know, to take your passport into different regions. But that's what I did. My mind very expansive. Had been really ever since my formative years as an investment analyst in Edinburgh, in Scotland, a long time ago. Mm-hmm. But if you do get the opportunity, you get seeded, and you'll get seeded with less than $100 million. Your break even will be $300 million. And you're only going to get there by posting a big number on your first year. So my first year, I got 50%. And so if you're starting a hedge fund today and you're listening to this, you've kind of got to look around for, there's always an asset class. I'm going to use the term bubble. Bubble is not necessarily what I mean, but that has just an overwhelming kind of thermodynamic power to the upside is thrusting higher. It's contentious. A lot of people dislike it. It is arguably overvalued. In the last, today, that would be, you know, the AI sector, NVIDIA. Going back 2 years ago, it was the reincarnation of Bitcoin. If we go back to my time, it was gold. I made 50% in the calendar year 2003 because I had a preposterously high allocation to gold miners, the equities. And to gold futures. Mm-hmm. And heavens, talk about the bucking bronco. The bucking bronco of a ride like that does everything to kick you off. You have to remember, markets don't know you love them. You know, you don't get to hold their hand and whisper sweet nothings. Markets are the French say méchant. They're evil. And, you know, it's a distribution. It's a wealth distribution system. They want your wealth. They want to distribute it to others. And heavens, there were times in that calendar year where I didn't think I was going to make it. But I made it. I got the 50%. I was buying gold from the British government's treasury. You know, they'd held it for 200 years. And they've got a lot of PhDs. The problem is they're predominantly PhDs in economics, which is a pseudoscience. And so all the king's men and all the king's women, you know, they couldn't get rid of gold fast enough at the very bottom. And I was the recipient. And that gave me 15 years, the privilege of 15 years of managing other people's money. Mm-hmm.
You know, Hugh, when you first started to explain your answer about that it is difficult to start a hedge fund now, I was thinking that maybe it was due to the environment that we, you know, the investing landscape that we're currently facing. But, you know, once you're explaining that you're trying to identify some type of bubble that is, you know, undeniable, whether you're long or short that, it seems like it's possibly a better time now. Would you agree with that?
Oh, you're saying that the frequency, the observations of bubbles has increased. Mm-hmm. That is conceivable. There is background music, which I think explains everything. You know, if you hear and you understand the background music, you'll make more sense of market trends. First and foremost, market trends are the number one priority. I mean, I get labeled as a contrarian, and yet I'm a trend follower. And so actually, the remarkable opportunities arise typically when the rest of the market is being contrarian, when they're actually going against a trend. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the frequency of bubbles or sharp movements, yeah, arguably, the nature of the economic process today has, if we reduce it to its simplest, three variables to GDP growth, population growth, productivity growth, and debt growth. And the first two are nada, nada. And so GDP growth is a function of the accumulation of additional debt to GDP. And if you think of double bookkeeping the ledger, we almost replicate the Chinese. The Chinese bureaucrats know the GDP, the calendar GDP number. They publish it in advance. They publish it on the 1st of January. And it's simply a function of how much money they spend to generate that. Mm-hmm. We're kind of something similar in that, you know, you can prophesize that it will be 2% GDP growth and debt to GDP will climb by 10 or 12%. But debt is a liability. And so if debt is going up 12% to GDP, then I've seen the future. I can tell you that assets to GDP will go up 12%. So, you know, we live in a world which the necessity, of course, is GDP growth. The only variable which is delivering is debt growth. That debt growth is the financing for which is provided from overseas, if you're in terms of you're in America. The overseas sector, the mercantilist trading nations in Asia, buy your financial assets. They do so to control their currency. And that then lifts the collateral that can support more debt. So we're talking about a volatility machine, Professor Michael Pettis, the modern day John Maynard Keynes, the great intellect of international trade, wrote a book, I want to say 15, 20 years ago, called The Volatility Machine. And to that end, if we consider 25 years ago, we had the Asian economic crisis, currencies being devalued across the region, which then became LTCM, which then became the NASDAQ bubble. And, you know, NASDAQ, an 80% decline was a historically with our data set was a kind of 1 in 100 year occurrence. Mm-hmm. And yet 7-8 years later, we get another 1 in 100 year occurrence. COVID, 1 in 100 year occurrence. And I do fear there's another 1 in 100 year occurrence approaching. There's an economic kind of storm which is about to reach landfall, if you will. So yeah, when you take debt to GDP, you kind of increase the oscillations, the frequency, and also the amplitude of the sine wave, which is all around us.
You know, there's so much to kind of bite into there, Hugh, but where I wanted to go with that is, you know, you mentioned that the rest of the world is really financing in some ways the debt expansion in the US. Do you think that is starting, you know, is there a trend that is starting to come to an end? And what are the consequences of that coming to an end?
There are no signs of that coming to an end. I would say that the rest of the world is not feeding this kind of inner propensity of the American population to wish to take on more debt. I think it's rather the other way around. The rest of the world, and principally it's China and trading satellites, even, you know, supposed friends, the Taiwanese, they operate a beggar thy neighbor economic policy. But if we address it specifically to China in the last 50 years has gone through the industrialization that America produced in the 19th century. And in a process of industrialization means that the sheer magnitude of very positive net present value investment opportunities is many times greater than the domestic savings pool. And so you typically run a trade deficit, and you're the recipient of the savings of the rest of the world. And that's how we made America great. And it came from London bankers. And every now and again, quite frequently, the refrain would go up, those bloody Americans, can't bloody trust them, bloody thieves and liars, which was simply, you know, the exuberance of an uptrend, you know, as the economy, you really started to get some momentum. There would always be you know, oscillations to the downside, and then we would see the bezel, we'd see fraud, etc., come to light. But that's a good model. Contrast that with the industrialization of Russia under Stalin, 1920s, 1930s. You could say almost they had no default in the sense that they had to finance it internally. So again, I'm saying to you, huge investment opportunity, no domestic savings. What do you do about that? Typically, you spread misery. So, you know, the Stalin traded the breadbasket of Russia, the great harvest of Russia, for the technical expertise and the transfer of technology from the Nazis. And I don't know, did 30 million Russian people die of starvation in a country which had the biggest kind of propensity to deliver food? It's not a model you would favor, but such is the need to finance the investment, and such was the strategic importance of industrialization that came to pass. Mm-hmm. China, of course, is somewhere in between those models, but China explicitly chose to finance itself domestically. And that requires, again, there's a transfer from the household sector. So Stalin was transferring food for the people. Z and his predecessors have been implicitly transferring wealth from the citizens of China. And that the manifestation of that has been that despite the Chinese economy growing from less than $1 trillion to almost $18 trillion today, to being the size of Europe, the currency is actually devalued. That makes no sense. Mm-hmm. And that's a great tragedy, because if the renminbi were trading 4.5 as opposed to 7.2, then The rest products, goods and services from the rest of the world would be cheaper for those billion plus Chinese. And we wouldn't be discussing deficient demand. We wouldn't be discussing surplus savings. So my point to you is that the savings are drawn down in the US because the beggar thy neighbor strategies of China. And these are, they sound like emotive terms, but they're actually kind of dry economic textbook terms. But that currency, you know, China's is not more productive. It's just in the scheme of things, because it subsidizes amazing infrastructure, which will never make a return, but it acts like a moat to create centers of manufacturing excellence. And then it's priced in a cheap currency. It's almost impossible for the manufactured sector elsewhere to respond. My music's starting in. This is very exciting. Where is my music coming from?
I was going to ask you, you know, about that, Hugh, is the other side of that coin, let's say, of having a stronger currency, would that not, you know, make the value of those products that they're exporting more expensive to the rest of the world and create that opportunity for other, you know, more competitive or cheaper labor markets to be able to compete with China instead?
That would be a good thing, you know, bring on the next guy. You know, the problem just now is they were the next guy, you know, when Clinton et al. Agreed to the submission and the entry of China. Yeah, I wonder if they had a pen in their diary and they said, I'm writing this for the future presidents of the United States of America. I'm telling you that on this day, I signed this agreement. And what I was thinking was, we've had a tumultuous kind of up and down relationship with the nation that we call China. Mm-hmm. That they have endured poverty. And with poverty, it has driven an ideological wedge between us. And I've signed this on the belief that if we're willing to suffer the short-term opportunity cost of opening our markets wide, I believe that we will create a trusted friend, a new trading partner, a rich trading partner, and that there will be synergy, that the sum of all of that will be that in 20 years' time, as you read this, Mr. Future President, you will be seeing the fruits of my endeavor at the turn of the century. Mm-hmm. That's not the case. Yeah, China at its peak going into the 2008 downturn was recording a trade surplus in manufacturers of almost 20% of GDP. I said, how fantastically high is that? When America was the dominant surplus nation, when we had devastated the rest of the world with two world wars, the corresponding peak for American and the surplus in manufactured trade was 6%. It was 6% in 1916-17 and kind of 1946 under extraordinary circumstances. Mm-hmm. So contrast that with the 20. And today, the figure is something like 15.5%. And it's persistent surpluses. It's a surplus every single year. Mm-hmm. It is actually the warning for Clinton et al. Back then was laid out in John Maynard Keynes. And please, if you hear Keynes and you go, oh my God, why are you talking about Keynes? I mean, if you cannot deal with intellect, if you apply prejudice in any walks of life, you know, shame on you and fool on your portfolio. Keynes is just an astonishing standard deviation person, and the world needs more of them. Mm-hmm. But Keynes said that we've seen this problem before. We saw it in the 1920s. We had a gold standard, and you settled the differences between trade by the exchange, either by telegram or physical delivery, but you would transfer, the surplus nation would be the recipient of gold, gold inflows. And gold was high-powered money. It would be held on deposit in banking vaults as a liability, and it would encourage the banking sector to extend more credit. And the notion of equilibrium was such that the surplus nation, in receiving this credit inducement, think of it as a better form of quantitative easing, that the economy would be strong, but boy, would it be even stronger. And to your point, kind of wages would go up. Maybe they would lose a bit of competitiveness. Demand would be red hot, and you would create demand for the goods and services in the rest of the world. So the system would seek equilibrium, and it would restore itself. Mm-hmm. That did not happen. The Fed back then wasn't necessarily federal, and it was largely headed by the New York Fed, Benjamin Strong. And you can read about this in Lords of Finance, wonderful historical tale. And the Fed were hard money guys, and like, gee, like, our economy's booming. We've got to immunize. We got to stop the high-powered money stoking up a super boom. But the system was conceived of as super booms would be the address to the deficiency of demand overseas. The Fed prevented that from happening. We got kind of entropy. You know, it seemed, the wall seemed very, very solid, but it fell down. Yeah. And that today is China and the other mercantilist nations owning between $7 and $9 trillion of predominantly, you know, treasury dollar bills and other claims on American assets. In doing so, it is leading to the abject poverty of, you know, low skilled, skilled, semi skilled. You know, it's encroaching all the way up, and the debt. The American embrace of the debt is preposterous. You've got no address. You have to put the damn thing on a credit card. Mm-hmm. You know, it is serfdom, and no one gets it. It breaks my heart.
Mm-hmm. As we've witnessed, let's say, this evolution of the relationship between the U.S. and China. You know, there was a point where everybody was talking about the possibility of China, you know, retaking Taiwan. And this is something that you have an interesting take on. And what would happen to, you know, financial markets if that, you know, becomes a point of contention between these two countries?
God forbid, yeah. But I found this time last year, I was having lunch in St. Bart's with a buddy, and My buddy's been in markets for a long time, and you're just one of those super successful sleeper type agents. You don't know him, you never heard of him, mm-hmm. and he likes it that way. And he always had a, I don't know how these things. I promise you, I'm not making this up. But yeah, he had a guy in Singapore, and it was really fixed up. Probably, I imagine, by the intelligence services, that they needed my buddy's kind of. They needed to know how he would react. You need other people. You need an audience. And then you got to interview the audience. What, you know, like, this is what I think. What did you think? You
like share a barometer.
Yeah. And, it, you know, this deep source of kind of Asian knowledge was just been bang on, correct. And about about 12 to 14 months ago, you know, started really, you know, the sleeper agent was saying, the Taiwan thing is really going live. And you know, we sat having lunch saying, you know, you would associate the probability being remarkably, remarkably small for such an event. And here we were saying, are we saying it's 5%? I mean, 5 would be an astonishing, a 1 in 20 event. Mm-hmm. Has it become a 1 in 5 event? I mean, preposterously scary, because should it come to pass, it would be the most significant and damning financial incident of all of our lives. Everything would end, markets would be closed, etc. I'm not saying it's going to happen, But I was noting again that, you know, Michael Pettis, Elon Musk, I mean, I don't know how many standard deviations bright, you know, Elon is. I know he's a polarizing figure, but my God, the guy is intelligent. Mm-hmm. And my God, he's tuned in. He seems to be Teflon protected from everything. And the brightest guy on the planet is saying, yeah, no, I do a lot of work in China. And the brothers are going in. I mean, are you ready? So it is scary. And yeah, people talk about it, but there are scant evidence of actually people having hedge. I mean, is a hedge necessary? I mean, we're all busted. You would think, I wish we'd see more dialogue about how one would seek a hedge. Obviously, it would be one where you'd have to realize it before the event. But, you know, so yeah, the it's given, to my mind, it's given alarming credence by the fact that the GDP calculator, yeah, I was saying to you that the ex ante deliverance of the year's GDP figure is breaking. You know, they're running out of, domestically within China, they're running out of variables. And their GDP calculator broke around about 2008. And we know that because ever since there's been an explosion in their own domestic debt funding. Mm-hmm. And so they've not been creating wealth. But it's really getting weak. You know, they created a $60 trillion bubble in domestic house and commercial properties. That's rolled over. The rest of the world is slowing down, as we're seeing in recent data. And so they're sitting there going, but I'm pressing 5. Why am I not getting 5% GDP growth?
Right.
And so, you know, of course, then we got the rumor of, oh, there's another COVID variant. We'll have to close it down. You know, if you can't make the GDP number work, then you've kind of got to close the damn thing down so that no one can say, you guys are incompetent. You messed up. You Chinese Communist Party, we don't want you no more. Mm-hmm. And that becomes a very quick leap into, you know, Jojo as a diversion. Again, I hope not. I hope not.
Would that be the, you know, the most destabilizing, you know, catastrophic event for financial markets because of the amount of synergies between the US and China, how they work together, how much they trade together, the amount of investment flowing back and forth? Is that the reason why, Hugh?
Yeah. I mean, China, US going to war, when two tribes go to war, you know. But I mean, we're not talking about the tragedy of, you know, the mishaps, you know, the horrible legacy of, you know, Vietnam and Iraq. We're not talking about, you know, the alarming confrontation between, you know, Ukraine and Russia, you know, which is together is less than 2% of global GDP. You know, you're talking about kind of almost, what, 40% of GDP. And then with Satya, you're talking about global confrontation. I mean, you know, nothing's priced for that. Mm-hmm.
So, Hugh, you know, we've obviously seen the fastest rate hiking schedule in US history here. So I want to dig a little bit more into this idea of debt to GDP. Why is it that, you know, this has really, why did the Fed need to take such a dramatic and aggressive rate hiking schedule here? And what effect does that have on the rest of the financial landscape that we, you know, we've obviously seen the handful of banking failures here, but are there other, you know, effects of that that you foresee that we have yet to see play out?
Yeah. So, you know, again, to repeat you, statistically, this is the fastest, and by magnitude of change, the greatest tightening in the Fed's history. And some people may scoff and say, hey, you know, Volcker went to 20% overnight rates. Mm-hmm. But that was very much at the end of the 1970s. And that was 40 years after the bankruptcy of the banking sector in America in 1930. Mm-hmm. And the ensuing 40 years, debt to GDP had fallen from 3.6 today's level to kind of almost one. And so I'd say you could take the debt to GDP of one, multiply it by Volcker's high rate of 20, and you get 20. If we round to the nearest point, you'd say debt is four times GDP today. They're at 5.25. You know, they're actually surpassed Volcker in the 70s. That's one way of thinking about it. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't happen. You know, there's a manual in Washington says, we're going to raise interest rates. Turn to page 125. Okay, what do we do? Right. You go by a quarter basis, 25 basis points. You bore everyone. You tell them months in advance. When you do it, you say there's going to be another one. You tell them it's going to be in 3 months' time. And then you repeat ad nauseum. Why? Why? Because the banking sector has assets and liabilities. The liability is what it pays on your deposits. It cannot match the Fed if the Fed goes rapidly, because the repricing of its loan book is slow. And so if it were to match pari passu the Federal Reserve, the net interest margin would collapse. And potentially that could threaten indeed the solvency of the bank. So that's why there's a procedure. That's why there's a manual. Motivation for the Fed's rapidity of response, obviously many things. For me, I think it was face saving for the institution, because I feel that Chairman Powell made a grave personal misjudgment when he was on American television and he was actually volunteering the notion that he was printing money with a digital press. I don't know how he got away with that, because that would be to break the Federal Reserve Act. It is a felony. And so, you know, and of course, right back at him within months, we had this, the supply disruption and the stimmy checks, and prices rose. And people said, well, you told us you're printing money. This is Fed inflation. I think that's my presumption in terms of why they went with so much rapidity and vigor. Mm-hmm. But it was occurring against a well-conceived argument. Arguments are always well-conceived. Doesn't mean they're perfect. But in the aftermath of the 2008 crisis and kind of trying to pick up the pieces and put Humpty Dumpty together again, they gave banks a pass in that they said, listen, you can own treasuries. And they do this globally. It's not specific to the US. Own our government papers of confiscation, call them what you will, but, you know, but own the treasuries, and you designate them as hold to maturity, and you don't have to mark it. It does not come through your P&L. You're going to lose money, and we won't tell anyone. Yeah. A reasonable idea. Why is it reasonable? Banks are like a very simple hedge fund. They have two choices. They can lend to the government. They can lend to the private sector. And the government's running deficits because the economy is weak. And so you're trying to encourage that. But of course, what happened? Oh, and then forgive me, there was a third element, but we discovered that the iPhone is a weapon of banking destruction. I mean, historically, deposits are kind of inert. Like, we don't like banks, but you got to take your passport. You got to, take 2 hours out of a busy day to get your money back. And suddenly we discover you just go, boop, it's gone. You know, what was it? I think 25% flowed out of Silicon Valley in the first day. And if they hadn't closed it the second, 70% of the deposits would have gone. That in itself, that knowledge, I think, puts a huge question mark actually on the sustainability of the bank as a risk-taking entity. I don't see now how you can put iPhone deposits with an industrial loan or a mortgage, etc. I don't see how they can reside. They're too unstable. And so when you ask me to consider the future, There is a heck of a lot of further dislocation to be wrecked upon the banking sector. I mean, we've yet to see credit risk emerge. And the Fed keeps raising rates, you know, and there's a, this hope that they will extend the insurance franchise to all accounts. People are fleeing the banks to get 5.25% on from the Fed. And the banking communities begrudgingly now having to offer CDs and other rate inducements, which are destroying their profitability. And we're still getting redemptions or withdrawals. And so those very vulnerable held-to-maturity portfolios, which are still deep in the red and which really threaten solvency, means that this story ain't over. Now, if you look at the banking sector index, you know, it's fallen 2/3. I wouldn't be short. I think there would be this probably a rip-roaring rally. I can't conceive of the economic environment, except maybe they ban short selling. I have made myself something of a scoundrel because I've tried to ask people to consider the notion of them imposing a gate on deposits.
That's actually exactly something that I wanted to ask you about is what risk you think there is of any type of a, let's say, a bank bail-in or some kind of capital control to control this flight of deposits.
So I think it's as high, if not higher, than the risk of confrontation with China, which is to say, it's one of these things, it's never going to happen, but now it's one of these things you got to go, gee, I kind
what
of
if it does
be aware of this, you know, that kind of thing. And of course, remember precedent, given the name of your show, I'm sure your listeners are shouting, the 1934 Federal Reserve Act. Yeah. What was the 1934 Federal Reserve Act? The American banking sector was insolvent. Mm-hmm. There wasn't the federal insurance on deposits. And money was being taken out and held in the form of gold coins. And there was effectively a gate when the government said, you can't own gold coins. Effectively, they say, put the money back in the bank. So they gated the banking system back then. And I do fear that when the everything is weakening, all prices are coming back to, you know, the pre-COVID level. You know, we're sitting with financial conditions as tight as they were in the summer of 1982. You break things, you get a very severe economic to my mind, you know, COVID was just an insane event. You know, we just had no goggles, no compass point. We were just completely lost. Mm-hmm. I'll give people a pass for making errors. I think there are a lot of good wise things and a lot of dumb things. You know, go figure. You know, that's what chaos brings you. I think we're at the end of, it's like a snake swallowing an elephant, and we're at the end of a chain, and you're kind of seeing, you know, people say, how can we have a recession? I just took a flight and it was like really busy, and you know, they just charged me $800 to go to Chicago or something. And it's like, well, yeah, but like for those 4 or 5 years, they've not been spending a penny on capacity, and you're still spending. You know, there was a great study of the San Francisco Fed. And the boost to savings from all of those stimulus checks. Yeah, sure. A lot of it was spent on Amazon and sent to China and came back. Mm-hmm. But it was saved, and it financed a lot of withdrawal from the labor force. But at the current draw, that money's gone by the end of the year. And you're already seeing there's some of the more arcane labor statistics. People coming back, you get the money's running out, and they're not necessarily finding a job in this environment. So the question was gating banks, and I mentioned short selling bans. Let me tell you, a short selling ban is preposterous. We did it in September 2008. We had the idiocy that the banking sector, the quoted banking sector, what was left, was trading pretty close to its all-time highs just as it went bankrupt, because you know, and what happens, what the regulator doesn't understand is when prices fall rapidly because no one has the P&L to take the risk. And indeed their risk is being cut because their profits are becoming losses. Short sellers are the only community where as the market goes down, their profits, their wealth is going up. Mm-hmm. And they have a great incentive to buy things and provide liquidity and stabilize markets. And so, you know, when you pull that plug out of the matrix, boom, we go down. But so again, I look at that bank index and I think, oh my God, are they going to ban short selling? Are we going to see like a 30-35% rally in these things? Anything is possible. Mm-hmm.
Hugh, I wanted to, you know, kind of transition to the talk about the Fed to ask you the question, in your eyes, do you see a need for the Fed? And if so, what would its roles be confined to?
I see a role for the Federal Reserve being that, you know, the backhaul, the lender of last resort, the ability to come in and buy good assets, viable assets, at a cheap price. And I would go further, actually. I would seek to improve that system. That kind of happens, except they buy everything. You know, they buy the good stuff, the bad stuff. They're like, we're from the Fed. We're going to waste your money. And you know, 2009 was the last major time, you know, the financial system had become binary. It was 0 or 1. It was Citigroup. Citigroup was marked almost at 0. It was bankrupt. So that's the 0. Or if the Fed comes in with an asset support system, TARP et al., then it reprices back to 1, and they chose that. And mm-hmm. I foresee them doing that without a doubt again and again and again. However, if we were to kind of bring together a lot of the subjects that I've loosely and poorly described, I would be seeking to stop the flow of funds. America sells its financial assets, physical and financial assets, to the rest of the world in a liberal manner. The US, it doesn't judge who buys them. It doesn't judge the quantity of the purchases. There are some smaller satellites, the UK, New Zealand, Australia, Canada, who are pretty much as open. And they've got, like the US, they've got very solid contract law, property rights. And as a consequence, we're in an environment where it's Alice in Wonderland. 80% of the world's surplus savings get invested in America. That would make sense if we were 1836 or 1876, mm-hmm. but it's 2023. And I think the sum of potential investments in America is conceivably much greater in terms of what could add value to the economy at large, but presently is conceived as being very small. And it is certainly dwarfed by domestic savings. So the US should not be a recipient of savings from the rest of the world. The fact that it is, again, is mercantilism, and it is the immunization, it's preventing their currencies from appreciating, and therefore it's the persistency of this serfdom of the global household sector to plutocracies elsewhere. So to your question, the role of the Fed, I think the Fed, this is a Treasury decision. It has to show the greatest, what does they say? The greatest honor you can do someone is to copy them. Say, you know what? We've been watching you guys. We gotta hand it to you. You're kind of smart. You kind of got us. You know, you closed your capital account, we kept ours open. You know, you've done well. And we're thinking we should copy you. Like, it's worked so well for you. Surely it's going to work for us. So what does that mean? It means that you know, the majority of sovereign holdings of U.S. treasuries are held in custody by the New York Federal Reserve. It's a public record, and we charge a withholding tax for their right to, you know, distort the American economy, for their right to get liquidity. You know, COVID, they needed to sell some treasuries. It was difficult. Federal Reserve came in, and they made the market liquid, and they were able to take that money, go back, fix their banking sector. And I'm saying, you know what? We're thinking about charging you. We're thinking there's a positive utility in all the crazy shit that we do. You know, we're thinking 3% a year. Anyway, whatever, pick a number. But I would put some, you know, some dirt into the grease or whatever, some sand, just to slow this thing down. And I'd create a fund. I think Norway's got oil. America's the land of the free, the land of plenty, you know. And rather than selling these financial assets to Johnny Foreigner, why don't we essentially set up an insurance fund? And citizens of America are given access to it, but means-based access. Yeah, there's just too many folk in America that are disenfranchised. They have no assets. Mm-hmm. I mean, I watched that god awful Spielberg movie the other night. I mean, Spielberg was one movie. Jaws, fantastic movie. The rest of it is The Hunger Games. But Ready Player One or something like that. You know, the take on the metaverse. The metaverse. Is dystopian, but really accurate in a world where you got nothing. Mm-hmm. I imagine you can be 6 feet tall, you can be blonde, you can have big breasts, small breasts, big ass, small ass, you can fight with Godzilla. Compare and contrast that to a world where you're going to take cocaine and it might even have less fentanyl, you might die. You're taking opiates because life is so damn grim. Life becomes grim in a world that doesn't, where the system cannot establish equilibrium, and we get caught and pushed further and further away. So again, long answer, but what does the Fed do? The Fed should be the emergency fund to right the economy when it looks like the financial sector is heading to zero. It should bring it back to one. Mm-hmm. I think it should be purchasing assets in that manner on behalf of the disenfranchised and trying to bring society a bit closer together. And finally, I don't think the Federal Reserve should be setting interest rates. It's just, you know, I'm sure there are people from a galaxy far, far away. I'm sure they seeded Earth. We call it God, but I'm sure it's like aliens from wherever, right? And if they were to pass by, they'd be like, I mean, we gave you the genius of markets. We gave you the yield curve. We gave you swaps. We gave you supercomputers. How on earth did you end up with 12 old bloody nincompoops meeting every 6 weeks and like the Vatican deciding on the rate of interest? It makes no sense and you're useless at it. So I'd abolish that part of the equation. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, to say that they think they know more than the collective of the free market seems to have a little bit of hubris built in it.
Tell me the last time they got something right.
So, Hugh, you know, from that perspective, with the amount of capital that flows into the U.S. from these foreign capital pools, does that make the U.S. equities, you know, highly overvalued, or is there a particular way that you have of analyzing the equity markets that make them, you know, not look, let's say, 70-80% overvalued, whatever that number is that you want to pick?
Oh, indeed. I mean, overvalued as a term only has relevance if you can conceive of a counter movement which is going to challenge the status quo. And I fail to think of a counter movement in the sense that you'd have to conceive of the closure of the United States financial account. like I was discussing, and it's only crackpots like me. I mean, sadly, there's no policy expert advice out there pushing that way. Policy advice and politicians are paid for by the predominant wealth pool, which is Wall Street. Wall Street, you know, they're. What is, I mean, as a question to your the people watching this, listening to this, you know, what is the global GDP is $100 trillion, global financial assets of 5x that, $500 trillion. What is the carry that the financial sector charges each year? Is it 1%? Maybe one's too high. You know, like you can't really do an ETF today as a manager and get paid more than 15 basis points, but say it's 100 basis points. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of money. That's $5 trillion that flows into, you know, everyone that has proximity to. I mean, I have proximity. You don't see Wall Street behind you, but they come here and they rent this place for an astonishing amount of money. You know, I'm just the janitor. I walked into this room and like there was a computer and there was lights and here we are. So the policy advice is not there. Anyway, so let's try again. I can answer this again and again. If we're not changing mercantilism, then GDP growth is going to continue to be a function of debt growth, debt accumulation. And the corollary, you can't create debt growth without creating corresponding increase in assets. The system keeps it going. And again, where I've been in profound disagreement with the Federal Reserve is, you know, the world is on, you said the word overvalued. Yeah, overvalued. But we could call that it's a fragile equilibrium. As long as the carry, you know, we have zombie companies because you take carry to zero and you can persist. You know, there's, you know, it's like traveling on a monorail, traveling on air. There's nothing, you can continue to move forward. There's no obstruction. Federal Reserve has like put 500 million tons of, you know, blockage on the track. And so then it becomes fragile. It's going to break things. And then the third way I come about that is historical data points. We don't have enough of environments such as today with the debt levels. It's largely, it's the 1950s, it's the proximity of the Second World War and you know, the public financing being shot to pieces. And so the debt is very high to GDP and you've got to, the debt's going to grow, but GDP's got to grow more. Yeah, and then the ratio comes down. And we've achieved that historically with this term financial repression. What does financial repression look like? Financial repression is negative real interest rates. And we had negative real rates. We were actually, the economy wasn't perfect, but it was kind of, you know, it was restoring itself. And we were transferring wealth from creditors, people with lots of money, you know, Saudi Arabia, you know, don't know what to do with it. You know, okay, well, let's confiscate it in real terms. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And giving it to the guys who come out of garages with, I don't know, today with AI technology, which is going to make you smarter than Einstein, you know. So, you know, when Apple is a $3 trillion stock, what is the expected return as an investor for the next 10 years when Apple's $3 trillion? It's probably zero. If it's $4 trillion, it's probably like -2% or something. That's actually how you heal the system. You have to overvalue the assets and transfer wealth from the creditor financing community to the real folk. Mm-hmm. We were kind of there and the Fed broke it. But the Fed, having broken the economy or soon to break the economy, having broken the banking sector, I believe you'll have nominal rates back on the floor and you'll have real rates negative again. And I would say to you, I think June the 12th we get CPI. I think it'll be 3.7. These things are very predictable. And the Fed's at 5.25, and they might even be at 5.5. Rates are positive. So they're actually transferring wealth from the real folk and giving the Saudi Arabias, the Chinas, and the Wall Streets a higher positive return. They're not thinking.
So Hugh, you know, you have some interesting ideas on, let's say, where we can, the average person can, you know, hide from this financial storm in some ways, or what are your ideas to be able to survive this time until we see another, let's say, gold type moment, which I want to get to, like you saw in let's say 2001, 2002 then.
I'm prolific on Twitter. Fills my cup with joy. I love the frisson of pressing the send button, the chance that I might be making an ass of myself. Bring it on. Again, in talking about the disenfranchised, if you know, Marxism is very relevant again today. Because you've got a generation of young folk and they're kind of giving up on the notion that they will be as successful as their parents. And that brings you to this notion of a permanent plateau and how really the debate's got to move on to how we redistribute your income. If it's not going to surpass this level, then we've got to share it more in a more equitable basis. That's at the heart of Marxism. My asset capitalism is trying to make finance cool enough so that we can bring some of the kids and say, finger to the man with a beard, you know. That is just intrinsically short, like human ingenuity. We're better than that. Like, you know, he misconceived. I believe we're in the fourth depression. First depression was, again, London banks financing the Industrial Revolution in the American heartlands. We had the first crisis. Was it too many canals, you know, built at the same time? But it created a run on the London banks, and they pulled gold out of money centers like Vienna, Paris, etc. What's his face? Hugo, what's he called? Hugo, God, I have such a blank on that. But Les Miserables is, you know, Russell Crowe made a musical about it. I mean, God. But that's kind of the ordinary folk going, gee, I just lost my job. I can't pay the rent. The bread prices are up my ass. You know, what's going on? Normally, it would have been the monarch. The monarch had gone crazy. It had invaded Russia. And you'd be getting it stuck to you by the monarchy. This was actually an economic global recession, which went on for over a decade. We call that a depression. It came to an end because, you know, we discovered gold in the Klondikes. And so we got a monetary injection. But that's towards the end of that period. You know, Marx is like, it's all over, folk. You know, he was wrong. Same thing actually came to pass again. You talk about today being the incidence of bubbles or sharp corrections being high. It was very high in the 19th century because of the pace of growth, the pace of technology change, and the pace of funding and finance. And so there was a second crisis celebrated by or reported by the Wizard of Oz, which was kind of 1875 to the end of the century. Again, it was resolved by the leaching technology, which opened gold fields from South Africa. So massive monetary stimulation, and we took out. The third one was the Great Depression. Not quite sure how it was resolved. Was it a world war? Was it, you know, but it was resolved. And then we're in this fourth one, which is like ever since 2009. It's a depression. We're trained that we can't use that term anymore. But I think it's a real and present reality in a lot of people's lives. I speak too much. What was the question again?
Where do you think that we can head as normal people to be able to, you know, at least preserve some of the value that you have hopefully been able to accrue to this point?
Okay. So like to understand my question, my answer, you've got to recognize that as a hedge fund starting in 2002, I was up against some of the smartest minds in the planet. Back then, you didn't have Facebook et al., didn't have iPhones. And one of the highest returns on intellectual capital was to be paid 2% management fee and at least a 2% performance fee. Mm-hmm. And if you didn't meet the folk, you would think they were the smartest people on the planet. It kind of has a grain of truth to it. Mm-hmm. And so I said to myself, hey, I'm all into audacity, but you know, it's just dumb to think that I can outsmart statistically the smartest people on the planet. And so I reconfigured and I said, well, why is it? Just because you're smart, you're not guaranteed to make money as a speculator. And you know, the answer to that is found in like just weird things happen in life. Life is capricious, you know, things get in the way. And so my franchise, my hedge fund franchise, is like when people throw in the towel and they go, oh my God, who could have thought that would happen? It'd be like, well, little me, I was writing about it 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. So first and foremost, I try and arm people with pro tips. You know, I'm as yet I'm not selling any trading school, but you know, I was a legitimate damn risk operator. You know, managed over $1 billion. I did so for 15 years. You know, I'm written up. You'll see, I'm everywhere in terms of you look at me. I exist. I'm not some guy passing off. I don't have some stupid thumbnail. And
we know the world has enough of those.
It has too many of them. So I refer to it, it's really the permanent portfolio, but I think of it quadratically like a compass: north, south, east, west. And there are essentially the four holy grails: equities, let's call it the S&P, treasuries, which is to say duration risk, alternatives, gold, the blessed gold, the precious community, the PDMs, Bitcoin, dare I say Bitcoin, property, index-linked securities. Kind of, it's a big sector. It's like $100 trillion, huge sector there, a quadrant model. And then the final one is cash. And, you know, and cash, of course, the return today is very high, 5% nominal rates. But that also may imply a currency pair, you know, holding a dollar versus something else, or shorting a dollar. And so with that framework, intellectually, my favorite asset class today is long duration US government bonds, because I think inflation is more of a symptom of the profound confusion coming out of COVID. I believe that inflation to be sustained requires the sustenance of monetary expansion. And we're seeing the opposite. I think it's going to be aggravated further in terms of credit contraction. So I don't see, you know, today a wallet is a telephone, and I don't see the dollars going in the quantity necessary to sustain the quantum of dollars going out if prices are 6-7% higher. Mm-hmm. So I think that's coming down. Secondly, I'm an advocate of mean reversion at the compass point level, not in terms of individual stocks or individual bonds or individual currency pairs. But when you talk about S&P, treasuries, you know, the price of gold, price of Bitcoin et al., I'm willing to entertain mean reversion. And all of, so if we ignore the positive carry from receiving the coupon on the treasuries, all of the price gains accumulated since 2006 have been wiped out in this bear market. And that's mean reversion. We're like over two, possibly three standard deviations below the mean, which is to say, if we had a bell chart curve, where we are, the percentage of the population which occurs in the past data set is tiny. This very rarely happens. So I'm there. However, I need legitimacy to build risk position. And as anyone knowledgeable will know, the treasury prices, the best thing you can say is for the last year, they haven't made new lows. They've kind of gone squiggly and sideways. Mm-hmm. And in some respects, that's pretty amazing given the great fear of inflation. And every month there's been these scare stories. And yet it's trundling along the bottom. So I'm represented in treasuries via call options. And again, I advocate people go as far out in the option market today. That would be kind of January 2025, it's quite far. Things change slowly in macro. And so you kind of want cheap theta. And you don't want to be a hero, just being kind of close to the money, no preposterously silly strikes. And that's where I am just now. If I look at the TLT, the ETF expression of that, 17 years of duration. And again, I'm saying duration or long dated because the longer the duration, the greater the price sensitivity and the less money you have to stamp up to make a dollar on your, a buck on your, a dollar on your buck, a buck on your dollar.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying to be able to hold that asset because of its liquidity and not necessarily actually locking it up for that long duration, right?
I'm saying that because of the duration, the price will be more sensitive. Mm-hmm. I'm saying that to make the similar, if you had $1,000, $10,000, I'm saying that you would need, I'm making this number up, you need $100,000 to make the same profit if you own the 2-year. It's the price sensitivity that comes in from the embedded risk from owning something which is rewarded so far out in the future. It's a boring technicality. Mm-hmm. So I have that, and it's just to say, I have options. I've got an absolute known loss if I'm wrong. You know, I never fear being wrong because I know the consequences. Mm-hmm. Typically, I'm kind of conceiving of a contentious narrative that may become an accepted new belief system, but contentious narratives are cheap. You know, and so the fear of being wrong is like, well, it was priced to be wrong. You know, mm-hmm. So that's what I have. And you know, if the price takes off, if we see the TLT expression trading through 110, it's presently about 100. It's been held low by the debt ceiling drama, melodrama. Mm-hmm. Then I would then begin to get the emergence of positive price trend legitimacy, and I'd want to own more of it as a risk asset. Mm-hmm. So I'm there. I've got a very modest allocation to equities. Equities haven't mean reverted. The expected return is kind of boring. Within that, I kind of want to own gold miners or uranium miners, agricultural stocks, the big base metal stocks like Rio's or Billiton or FCX, etc. But you know, there's a damn awful economic calamity coming. They're pretty weak. What we've discovered this year, of course, is there's another bubble brewing. Bubbles, I'm with a small amount of money, I'll play. So I've been kind of allocating into the dreaded NVIDIA. Never short a positive trend. You know, you make money cowardly when you're shorting. You wait until it's falling and falling and falling, and then you short it. You know, like not when it's going up, up, up. That's where you're long it. So I've got a modest expression there. I guess not a popular opinion perhaps on your show, but probably my biggest risk expression today is Bitcoin. That is no valediction on technology or otherwise. It's simply that it resides within a bucket of other assets of arguably $100 trillion, and that it has fallen in price. It has mean reverted by 60%. That the sum value of Bitcoin today is kind of $500 trillion. The gold is, I want to say, $12 trillion. That the US Treasury is $32 trillion. That real estate is what, $45 trillion. And so $500 trillion, it doesn't, you know, like it could be $1 trillion and it doesn't really change the world. Mm-hmm. It can double, whereas I can't conceive of any other asset class doubling. So for me, I look at Bitcoin, let's call it 25,000 in the middle. My tail is, and I attach quite a strong probability that it could touch 10,000. But the probability that it could be four times greater is reasonably high. And so faced with that projection, you know, I take Bitcoin every time. But again, it's like, you don't have to love it. You don't have to hate it. You just have to be objective. And, you know, throw in, and clearly I'm a bit of an absurd philosophist. And so a bit of absurdity, and why not? And then lastly, you'd be, like I said, you'd be hosing down some of those 5% yields, and a protection that I favor is being long the dollar and short the Chinese currency. You know, it's, everything's gone right for it, and it's devalued. Are you telling me everything's going to go wrong for it and it's going to revalue higher? I don't think so. So I've got those grease on my chain. That thing's flowing. You know, gone 7.2. It's been particularly weak this year. Mm-hmm. I don't see what's there to interrupt us. But you know, think about it. I'm saying broadly diversified. I don't have to trade every day. I can ignore it.
Yeah.
Events arise and quarterly, I might go, yeah, you know, I'd be at the end of the next quarter, if the bonds are moving, I'd be like, you know what? Now this has to be my biggest risk allocation. It's my biggest percentage of NAV, but it's not my biggest kind of vol contribution to the book. So things like that. Mm-hmm.
So Hugh, you know, there's a lot of people that say obviously on our show that gold is set for this tremendous gain. And, you know, you having ridden that last, let's say that last bull market from the bottom there, do you see this as a reasonably, you know, similar time in some respects because of a lot of these macro factors? Or is it because, or not necessarily because, but is it possibly, you know, in a different scenario because of the absolute price level that we're already at?
Gold's fine, you know, like within that portfolio thing, I think I had 5% in gold and 20% in Bitcoin. And even there within the Bitcoin, I was buying the gruesome grayscale trust where it's at a 40% discount. And I'm hoping, so I've had mean reversion in the asset class, and I'm hoping that maybe a new administration in the course of the next 2-3 years, a new SEC chair, and we turn this closed-end fund into an ETF. They didn't allow that to happen previously because they feared people would be buying more as you made an ETF. Now I think they'd be selling it. They'd be heading to the exit. Anyway, but I like contention. You know, my favorite asset class, you say to people, yeah, I want to buy the 30-year treasury. You go, you're crazy. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I won't respond to that. There's nothing kind of, I mean, gold is, again, just to irritate your audience further, you know, gold's it's a dumbass asset, you know, serves no purpose, mm-hmm. Except as gold, right? To my, you know, gold is sticking it to the man, finger to the man, just saying, you know what, you guys lost it. In the Fed, we trust, really? Maybe a few years back, but you know, you just keep getting it wrong. I'm bailing on you guys, and it's a guerrilla warfare kind of technique. Yeah, I'm all for that, and there are moments that it works. And the price has the legitimacy of trend. The price performance, price relative to treasuries, is giving a very strong indicator. So what's not to love about gold? It's just the love. It's just the knowledge is that we've been here before, that it's like a most favored nation status. And people like, it's, you know, people go on tour and say, I'm never selling. And, you know, my favorite story is, you know, Jesus going to the disciples and like, who am I again? Like, you're God. You're the Almighty. It's amazing. It's incredible. Can I touch you? And he slaps them. He's like, don't touch me. And he says, what if I was to tell you that, you know, the cock will crow and you will have absolutely denied all knowledge of me? And they're like, impossible. Boom, boom, boom. I promise you, you are my salvation. And you know the story, the cock crows. And they said, the guy with the beard, never seen him, never heard of him. And so that's, you know, gold to my mind is like hanging out with Jesus. There's going to be a point where you deny him. I saw that in the autumn of 2008. I saw very smart family offices that had accumulated gold as an insurance of the harbinger of great economic catastrophe. And I saw that those portfolios, that everything that made sense in what was about to happen had first to be, you had to reject it. I saw, you know, people had to kick out. I mean, the value that was created in treasury tips, index-linked securities, you know, gold went from, I think, 1,100 to like 550, 600. I mean, it recovered quickly, but, you know, the tales of woe from those who had, those who were depending on it to bail out their risk investments elsewhere, and they couldn't hold it. So yeah, the alternative is you just own gold. And of course, you've got a can of beans, you've got a black sock, you've got a, you know, you've got a gun or something. But, you know, in the real world, it's a bit more complicated. But I mean, I'm just waiting. I'm like, I don't care. I've got 5%, who cares? But 10, like 50%.
Go ahead, sorry. You know. Yeah.
No, just, you know, I'm just looking for some people to, I'm looking for the believers to leave the church of God. Mm-hmm.
Like you say, that's why you have this macro structure that provides you with, you know, this diversification until you see that green light, right? Excellent, Hugh. Well, I think that's a good place to kind of wrap up today's conversation. That was a real treat, the wide-ranging nature of everything that we discussed here today. Is there anything else that you'd like to leave our listeners with before we do?
Just the fact that I get really lonely, you know, and I'm on Twitter, Hendry_Hugh. I'm doing this kind of vibe every week on my podcast, you know. So if anyone's interested, if they drop comments, I'll try and answer on the YouTube et al. So no, I'm enjoying it. It was a fun conversation. Nice way to spend the afternoon.
Absolutely, I appreciate your time and sharing your wisdom with us, Hugh. And of course, just to repeat that on Twitter, Hendry_Hugh and HughHendry.com as well, right?
Hugh Hendry Official for YouTube.
Perfect. Thanks so much for your time today, Hugh. I really appreciate the conversation.
Thank you.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.